Aflamet Amid Beis, and we're moving towards the bottom of the page. And you remember we had two stories about.
We're on Lamed Aleph.
We're about to start Lamed Aleph. Yeah. I'm just saying on Lamed Amid Beis, just as a revision, I like to do a little revision. We had two stories, which begin four lines up from the bottom. Abai Havi Yosef Kamei De Rabba. In the first case, Abai was sitting in front of his Rebbe Rabba. And Chazio and Rabba, his Rebbe, saw Abaye Davika Bodach Tuva. He was exceedingly happy and in what we call a very light mood, you know, sort of like almost in a joking mood. Omar, and he turns to his Talmud with a very harsh words because he quotes a pasuk that seems to indicate what mood is appropriate for a Jew. And he says, Vigilu bira'ada. You know, although Vigilu means you're allowed to be in a state of joy and happiness, but it's got to be bira'ada. Ksiv, and that's what the Torah demands. Omar lo, so the response he got from his Talmud in self-defense, Abai said, Ana I tefillin mancha, I'm wearing tefillin. And somehow the wearing of tefillin is a demonstration that I'm in a serious mood. Tefillin, we said, we spoke about at great length, is Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shomayim. So don't think that I am, again, to use Rashi's term here, two lines up from the bottom of Rashi, Kiporek Ol. I'm not someone who's breaking the yoke of heaven off my shoulders. On the contrary, I am very much wearing, I'm ordained with this beautiful ornament, which is called Tefillin, which is itself a Kabbalas Ol. Kabbalas Ol means the exact opposite of Prikas Ol. And now the Gemara tells almost an identical story. And this case, it's Rabbi Yirmiyah Havi Yosef Kamei de Rab Zera. And in this case, it's very strange because Rabbi Yirmiyah, in this case, is a Talmud of Rab Zera, but he has a comment on his Rebbe Rab Zera, Chazia. This is the way the Mefarshim interpret it. Rabbi Yirmiyah sees his Rebbe Rab Zera, Davi Ko Badach Tuva, and he's in a very jovial mood. Omar Lay, so he asked him in a question by quoting a pasuk in Mishlei. And what does the pasuk say in Mishlei? Bechol etzev yehem mosar ksiv. Yehem mosar means it's an advantage, it's a surplus, you'll get reward because of etzev. And etzev, which means a very somber, we said solemn mood, is absolutely antithetical to your joking around mood. So again, he doesn't use a pasuk which commands us vegilu bira'ada. That he drops out because that would not be appropriate for a Talmud to say to his Rebbe. But rather, he sort of sings the praises and recommends with great, you know, with a certain emphasis here the etzev moment. And in a sense, I think, again, this is just my take on it, Rabbi Yirmiyah was asking his Rebbe, Rabbi Zera, I understand that you want to be, you know, in a jovial mood, but why forfeit the possible reward that you could get from etzev? Because yehei mosar. Mosar means you'll get duly rewarded for it. Amalei ana tefillin mancha. I have tefillin on my head, and therefore that is something that puts me in a great jovial mood. Tefillin is something that's absolutely connected to Torah, and Torah is absolutely connected to simcha, and therefore I'm willing to forfeit, at least on a temporary basis, this extra advantage of etzev for the sake of simcha, for the sake of tefillin. Etzev, that was your word, Tom, last week. You remember you used the word solemnity. I thought that was a good word, you know. Okay. Next. Now we have the stories about breaking glasses and things of that sort because people were getting too carried away. So David, we're doing some revision. We're on the last line of Lamed Amid Beis. And the Gemara tells us that Mar Berei de Ravina, he was the son of Ravina. Avad Hilula Lebrei, he had a wedding celebration on behalf of his son. Chazinu L'Rabbanan, and he noticed the rabbis at the celebration, Havikah Badchi Tuva. They were exceedingly jovial and you know, usually the word bedicha or bedichusa is a word for a joke. Yeah. And he was not happy about that. You know, he felt that even in the throes of something as intensely joyous as a wedding, nevertheless, we still have to balance between Gilu and Ra'ada. And in order to snap them out of this mood and get them into a more serious mood, and here we go on to Daf Lamed Aleph, Omed Aleph, I say he brought Kasa, which is a drinking cup, Demokra. Mokra is made out of glass, very, very expensive. The Gemara doesn't waste, is not shy about telling us exactly how expensive. Bas Arba Mea Zuzi, it was worth 400 zuz. Utavar Kamayu, and he broke it in their presence. And they snapped out of that very jovial mood, that lightheaded mood, and they became very serious. A similar story we have in the case of Rav Ashi. Avad Hilula Lebrei, he made a wedding for his son. Chazinu L'Rabbon, and he saw the rabbis Davi Kabadchi Tuva, they were exceedingly joyous. Aisi Kasa Dezugisa Chivarta, he brought a glass of white glass. Apparently white glass is a very expensive glass. I mentioned to you last week that in certain cities in Europe, they have special auctions for these kinds of glasses. V'tavar kamayu, and he broke it in front of them, v'as tzivu, and they snapped out of their lightheaded mood into a mood of atzivu, from which is a conjugation, a verb of the noun etzev that we saw before in Mishle. But the third story, this is what I call too excessive. I mean, this is a very difficult piece of Gemara. And believe me, when we get together a little bit later on, I want to talk to you about this Gemara. But first, I want to finish the revision and then go on a little bit. Amru le'ei rabbanon, l'rav hamnuna zute be'ilula de mar berei de ravina. At the wedding of mar berei de ravina, which is the wedding that we spoke about earlier, the Rabbanon came over to Rav Hamnuna. Zuti means he was the younger Rav Hamnuna. You know, sometimes they had two Amoraim by the same name. So in order to distinguish one from the other, they called one the Zuti. The Zuti means the younger one. And what did they say to him? Lishrei lon mar. Lishrei is the conjugated verb of the word shira. And they were asking him to sing some sort of a poetic song that would be meaningful for the rabbis. Obviously, you can't just write a couple of short lines from a lazy poet. You have to write something meaningful. Amar Lahu, Rav Hamnuna, responded with a shira, and it's not exactly the kind of shira that you want to put to the most joyous symphony orchestra. He said, "Vaylon lemisnan, woe to us that we will die." Vaylon lemisnan, and one of the questions we asked last time is why the repetition of the same words twice. Amri Le, when they heard this song, they were so flabbergasted. Anan mai nane basroch. What is the refrain that we should be responding? You know, every song requires responsive singing. Omar Lahus Rav Hamnuna Zute responded, if you want to know what you should be saying the following. Hey Torah, where is the Torah that we studied? Hey mitzvah, where is the mitzvah that we fulfilled, all the mitzvahs that we fulfilled? De magnu alon. Okay, that's an important phrase. De magnu alon. Alon means on us. And magnu is the conjugation of the word magen. Right, like you have, for example, the first responders are called Magen David or Magen Adam, right? So those are ones who come to protect us. Where is the Torah and where is the mitzvah that's going to protect us? And the Mefarshim explain, we'll see it soon in Rashi, and Rashi's on the third line down from the top, something called Dina Shel Gehenom. Dina means the judgment for Gehenna, meaning he was absolutely awestruck, fear stricken by the concept or the inevitable judgment after death that would send a person to, you know, not to heaven but to the other place. And the only way we could be protected for that is through our Torah mitzvahs. And basically he was saying to them, have we really engaged in Torah mitzvahs. And maybe even if we did so, we only did it superficially. It wasn't really coming from the depths of our nefesh. And therefore, it won't really do the job of protecting us. And that's what he was concerned with. So this all happened at one single wedding. A lot was going on at that wedding, and nothing that you would call... Now, I just want to tell you one thing before we start the Gemara that we haven't begun yet. And that is that in certain Hasidic circles, you should know this, especially in Satmar, they have what's called a badchan at a wedding. This guy is professional. And I saw it at my sister-in-law's wedding. My sister-in-law married a fellow from Williamsburg, from the Satmar community. He's a little himself more modern than the Satmar Hasidim. He doesn't wear a beard or anything like that. But nevertheless, it was a traditional wedding in the Satmar sense, and they had a badchan. Now, the badchan comes at the chassan's tish. So you just have to picture the following scene. There's a dais, the chassan is there, and all the greats of Satmar are there, and me. I was like a little bit out of place over there, you know. I belong maybe in the Mizrahi in Australia, I don't know where, but certainly not at this dais of Satmar Dayanim and Rabbanim and so forth. But I was the Masada Kedushin, so they couldn't kick me out, because I was officiating at the wedding for my brother-in-law. In any event, halfway through the celebrations, the Badchan comes in, gets up on a table, speaks in heavy Yiddish for 45 minutes. And if I told you there wasn't a wet eye in the audience, he was giving the most fire and brimstone musashmus that you could imagine. Telling the chassan publicly what he's about to embark on and what the responsibility is going to be to raise a family. And there wasn't one single joke. I said, wait, at some point, is he going to crack some jokes? Nothing. 45 minutes of straight, I mean, the tension in the air from his serious words describing the judgment of God and so forth, you could slice it with a knife. That's how thick it was. So I'm just pointing out to you that what we see here in the Gemara, and we think, oh, this was, you know, 16, 17 centuries ago, but we don't have it today. It still actually exists in our time at a wedding. But Belin Eder will try to add a little bit more about this later. I want to move on because I know, you know, we're always looking at the clock to the new Gemara.
So, sorry, Rabbi. So, yeah. Are you saying it's common in Haredi circles to still have something like this?
I don't know. I only saw it in that wedding.
I always thought the Badchan was the guy who told all the jokes.
That's what I was expecting.
That's what you're going to tell me. Just spent 45.
But this was nothing like it. Honestly, when I think about some of the things he said, I still shudder. I still shake. And this, you know, Baruch Hashem, they married a long time. Omar Rav Yochanan Mishum Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay, get serious, guys. Asur li adam sheyamale schok piv ba'olam hazeh. This is Rabbi Yochanan. You know, this is a first generation Amor. In the name of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, one of the greatest Tanoim that we have. We are not permitted to fill our mouths, lemale piv, right? Bischok. I'm rewriting the sequence of the words to make it easier for us to understand. Schok means a smile on our face. We're not allowed to get carried away with a smile. Every time we smile during this lifetime, it's got to be partial, but not complete. Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, and you'll all be familiar with this Pasuk, from Tehillim, Oz Yimole Schok Pinu Ulshoneinu Rina. Then, okay, and we'll see what then refers to, but Oz, not now in this world, but Oz in a different world. Oz, the word Oz always refers to another world. Yimole Schok Pinu. Then, and only then, will our mouths fill up with joy. Ulshoneinu, and our tongues, Reno, with full song. And what, V'emasai? Emasai means when? You know, when is this going to happen? Because the Pasuk is already foretelling and prophesizing about a period of time in which we will have a full mouth of song and praise. Bizman sheyomru, this is the next part of the same Pasuk, this is the Sefer of the Pasuk. Bizman sheyomru, Yomru Vagoyim, the Goyim will recite and announce Higdil Hashem Lasosim Eila, how great is the glorious miracle that God has done with these, meaning with the Jewish people. Could you imagine when the nations of the world would say such a thing? It's so difficult for us to even imagine. Amru Olav al Reish Lakish, they said about Reish Lakish, who was the outstanding disciple of Rabbi Yochanan, Shemiyamav, during all his days, Lo Milas Chok Piv Ba'olam Hazeh, he never, you know, expanded his smile in this world, Michi Shema'a, from the time that he heard Mirab Yochanan Rabbe, this statement from his Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan. Now, the question I want you to think about as you go through this is why does the Gemara feel compelled to tell us that Rabbi Yochanan fulfilled the dictum of his Rebbe, and when after Reish Lakish, excuse me, when obviously you know everybody should be fulfilling this dictum. You know, my kavash, what's the chiddush here? You're telling me Reish Lakish heard it and he lived up to it. I mean, obviously, why would I think? Why would I think otherwise?
He's quite the prankster.
Maybe, I don't know. He was definitely a character.
He's the one who was the criminal, wasn't he?
Right. He was the chief of the thieves. Tana Rabbana. Now what we want to do now is start a brisa, which the work you know that's cut out for us here is to compare this brisa to our Mishnah back on Daf Lamed Amud Beis.
Because something new, or is this?
No, this is all a continuation. Yeah. Okay. Now this brisa is awfully similar to our Mishnah. And what I'm going to be asking you is, why does Gemara feel compelled to bring this brisa? Usually a brisa adds something that we don't know from the Mishnah, and certainly that's going to be the case here. Ein omdim lispalel, that's already the opening three lines, so I'm not going to expect you to come up with a difference here, because it's word for word verbatim. But here it says, lo mitoch din. Din means judgment, so you don't go from judgment straight into tefillah. So imagine if, let's say, the judgment lasts until mincha time, they've got to do something in the middle, I don't know what yet, we'll see in the brisa, in order to make a wedge, an interruption between the din, the final judgment, that was the verdict that was handed down, and their prayer for mincha. In that case, mincha, or whatever tefillah was, I'm just giving you an example. The lo mitoch dvar halacha, and not from the study of halacha. What do you mean, not from the study of halacha? I studied halacha, now I can't daven? And when can I daven? Look at this one. Ela mitoch halacha psuka, by looking into the codes of the halacha. So my first question to you, and you're going to have to really read Rashi carefully, to figure out what is he negating, what is he prohibiting, meaning halacha, dvar halacha, and what is he advocating, halacha psuka, and what's the difference between the two? Now the Gemara takes over, and again, how do I know that this is the end of the brisa? That's always a challenge when you learn the Talmud, to figure out when the Talmud quotes a brisa, or a Mishnah, or whatever it might be, to figure out when do you put the end of quote. And the answer is, whenever you see a shift from Hebrew to Aramaic, as soon as you see the Gemara going from Hebrew to Aramaic, you know it's the end of a quote, and that's where you can put the two dots, if you know what I mean, or the inverted commas, and then you embark upon the Gemara's analysis. So in this case, Hechi Dami is Aramaic, meaning what does it mean, or literally, What's the case? Hechidomi means what's the case? And if you look in Frank's dictionary, which I keep recommending to you, I heard that the ELC has ordered many copies of the book because there's such a mad rush to buy it. It's called the Practical Talmudic Dictionary. So you'll see an entire section called Hechidomi, and he gives you it's beautiful. He tells you where to use it and how to use it. So hechi dami halacha psuka. You told me that before I daven, I should study halacha psuka. What is halacha psuka? And now the Gemara embarks upon three different examples of halacha psuka. Okay, then. Now let me just give you a little background. The first of the three examples requires the most, real scholarship to prove it, and that's the law of nida. you know, when a woman could go to mikvah. The second halacha, which is a little bit easier, but also requires a great deal of halachic thinking, is a halacha in what we call hafrashas trumos umasros, right? Which means that you take, let's say you take 1/10 of your produce, and you take 1/60 or 1/50 of your produce. Well, the first one is dedicated for masa, the second for truma, and there are very strict laws about when you're allowed to eat that food. And the third example the Gemara is going to give is the case of behemas kodshim, meaning the status of an animal that was sanctified for the mizbeach, but before you actually did the shechita, you know, before it was actually slaughtered. Slaughtering is the first of a series of what's called avodas hakarbon. There are four categories of avoda, the first of which is shechita. What benefit would he be allowed to have from this animal, which is hegdesh, before the shechita process begins? Now, there's no logical connection between A, B, or C. The only, shall I say, common denominator between the three is halacha psuka. Halacha psuka means a principle in halacha which is undeniable. It's very clear cut and it's universally accepted. So let's go through them one by one. Okay. The first one, which is the law of nida, requires us to give a little bit of introduction here and background to the laws of Nida. The most important concept in Nida is called Shivas Yomim Nikim. Again, if I had a blackboard, I would write this on the board, but if you don't mind copying over in yours, Shiva, which means seven, or you could write Zion, Yomim Nikim. Yomim Nikiyah means days in which nothing comes out of her womb, you know, for her makar, no blood whatsoever. They're absolutely naki. Naki means totally clean, which means that she has to make what's called a bedika to check out there, make sure that she's absolutely clean. And then the very next day becomes the first day. And if for 7 days we can guarantee that she was clean, then she has Zion Nikiyah. Now, the law is as follows. As far as the Torah is concerned, then she doesn't need Zayin Nikiyim unless she becomes a Zava Gedola. Okay, what's a Zava Gedola? So a woman's cycle is divided up into two parts. There are what's called Yemei Nida and then the Yemei Ziva. Okay, now, when does a woman require Zayin Nikiyim? That's only after she has 3 consecutive re'ios. She sees Dam on 3 consecutive days during Yemei Ziva. Okay? Because as I told you, her month is divided into 2 categories, Yemei Nida and Yemei Ziva. So as far as the Torah law is concerned, only when she has this kind of a re'iyah, which is called Ziva, and she sees it 3 days consecutively, then and only then would she be required to count Zayin Nikiyim before she's allowed to resume her relationship with her husband. Now suffice it to say that in most cases, a woman does not see Dam during Yemei Ziva. Seeing Dam during Yemei Ziva is the aberration, it's the exception to the rule rather than the rule. So generally speaking, when a woman sees Dam, according to the Torah law, she waits until she stops seeing Dam, and it could go on for days and days, it doesn't matter, and right away she can go to mikvah. She doesn't have to count Zayin Nikiyim. It's only because she was in Nida and not in the days of Ziva. It's only during this rare occasion where during that Yemei Ziva, it's an 11-day period of time, where she saw 3 days consecutively in those days of Ziva, then she needs Zayin Nikiyim. But Omar Abaye says, if you want an example of halacha psuka, ki ha de Rabbi Zera, it's like the case of Rabbi Zera, the statement of Rabbi Zera. The Omar Rabbi Zera, Rabbi Zera said with regard to Nida, Benos Yisrael, the pure and holy daughters of Israel, hechmiru, they accepted upon themselves a chumrah. What's a chumrah?
A strict, severe
law. Alatzman, they accepted upon themselves. Sha'afilu Roos, even if they see, Tipas Dam, one little teeny drop of blood, Kechardol, it's as small as a mustard seed, nevertheless, Yoshvos Olea Shivadikir, they took it upon themselves that there's a possibility that maybe their Re'iyah was during Yemei Ziva. I'm just going to read to you his footnote and then I'll explain it to you because he has a very fine footnote here. He says, Yoshvos Olea Shivas Yomim Milvad Yom Re'iyas Tipas. Now, okay, so the first day is the day after she saw the blood. The day that she saw the blood, you know, let's say she saw the blood in the morning and in the afternoon she did a bdika and she's clean. That day itself is not counted as one of the days. That's true even on Doraisa level. But she considers herself, because she saw a small drop of blood, to be a Zava Gedola. A Zava Gedola is a woman who during the Yemei Ziva saw 3 days consecutively. And it doesn't matter when she saw this Tipas Dam. She accepted upon herself, I mean, this was the community of Israel, right? She accepted upon herself, Beinim Rasa Bizman Aroy L'dam Nida, even though it's during that part of the month which would be Dam Nida, which she doesn't need Zayin Nikim, Beinim Rasa Bizman Haroy L'dam Ziva, Vatam lechumra zu. Why did the women take upon themselves such a chumra? Because ein kol anoshim bikios. Not all of the ladies are experts lechoshev to keep a very meticulous counting. Emasai, where are they holding? Are they in the Yemei Nida or are they in Yemei Ziva? And therefore, they considered it lechumra as if they saw this dam during Yemei Ziva. But wait a minute, even if they saw, let me grant you that they saw during Yemei Ziva, they made this calculation and they got confused. So what? They only saw one Re'iyah. We said before that in order to be a Zava Gedola, to require Zayin Nikim, you need to see 3 days consecutively. Is Gam Re'iyah Achash Al Tipas Dam Echmir Al Atzma, and even with one small drop of blood, they accepted this Chumra, like as if they were a Zava Gedola. And why? Because they didn't want to make a distinction between a case where they saw one Ria, a case where they saw two Rios. Also, the Gemara is going to tell us, we're not going to get to it here, but in Masechta Nida, that maybe they saw that Dam during Bein HaShemashos, and that already could count for 2 different days, because it belongs to yesterday, belongs to today. And this Halacha of Rabbi Zeira is called Halacha Psuka. Nobody denies it. So I have to tell you, Rabosai, today in our day, any woman who sees Dam is going to have to count Zayin Nikim. Mm-hmm. Now, after she counts Zayin Nikim, if she sees Dam, it could be that she doesn't have to count Zayin Nikim. That's already a different question. Rava Omar, Rava gives another, I'm stretching it by 5 more minutes just so that we get the, and then you'll have to do the research here. Rava gives a second example of Halacha Psuka, Ki Hadrav Hoshaya. Rav Hoshaya had halacha with regard to Trumos and Maisros. What was his case? The Omer Rav Hoshaya. Rav Hoshaya specifically honed in on the case of Maser. Okay. Marim Adam Al Tvuasa. Okay. Marim. What does Marim mean? Marim is a verb, the noun of which is Ha'aroma. Hey Ayin Reish Mem Hey. Ha'aroma. You remember that in a pejorative sense, the word haroma referred to the nachash hakadmoni, because he was nachash arum mikol chayas asoda. He tricked, you know, Adam Arishon and Chava to eat from the Eitz Hadas. But really, the word haroma in this context is a little bit more positive. It still has a drop of pejorative, negative input. But haroma means that sometimes you could find what's called a legal loophole. And how could you find a legal loophole to the laws of Maser? And the answer is that all grains are covered by a chaff. That's called in Hebrew a motz, mem vav tzadi. You'll see it in the next line in the Gemara. And you have to take the chaff off before you bring the grains into the house in order to be chayav in maaser. So imagine the following thing. Instead of taking off the chaff outside, I'm going to bring my grains inside my house and then I'm going to take off the chaff. Rabbi Osei, what's it called in English? This has nothing to do with being a scholar in Torah. But what's it called in English to take off the chaff? Do you know the word for that? So please write this down if you can. Winnowing. Yeah. So winnowing means they put the grains on a pan. And they throw it up into the air. The air blows away the chaff, and the grains fall back down, and there's no chaff. That has to be done in order to be obligated in Maaser outside the house. But what do these guys do? And we'll soon see why they did it. Is Marim Adam al Tvuaso? Tvuaso means his grains. He does a harama. Harama, remember, is like a loophole to circumvent the law. Umachnisa. And he brings the grains into his house, bimotz shalah, while it's still wearing its chaff, its covering. And he didn't do what's called gemar malacha. Gemar malacha means the complete, completing the preparation, which is called winnowing. And why did he do this? Kidei shetehe behemto ocheles. He wanted to give this grain to his animals. Uptura min hamaser, and it's exempt from maser. So again, it wasn't that he was trying to avoid the laws of maser, but he needed to feed his animal, and rather than go through the entire process,
say to his animals, isn't that exempt from maser anyway?
Well, there were sheva kovim to maser. There are seven things that engender the chi of maser. One of them is called achilas keva, kuf bet ayin, which means that we sit down to eat a regular meal. Then is something called achilas aroi, which is a temporary kind of meal, like a snack. That does not engender kviel maser. That doesn't engender the chi of maser. When you feed something to the animals, by definition, that's called achilas aroi. It's only a temporary kind of achilah. It's not an achilas keva. And the halacha is that if you bring your grains into the house before you took off the motz, that's called knisa labayis, kodem gmar malacha. And knisa labayis, kodem gmar malacha, only generates an isra achilas keva, but not achilas haroi. Therefore, he's technically allowed to feed his animals. Now, Rabosai, again, we're running out of time. So what I'm going to ask you to do is go through this gigantic Rashi, Dibra Maschil B'mot Shalah. I don't know if you see it. It's about 10 lines down from the top of the page. And I guess if the doc is not here today, maybe the three of you could learn together. Is that possible?
Yeah.
Oh, the doc, he works on Sunday.
He works on Sunday.
Oh, yes. I was expecting him, and then it just occurred to me, Nafala Simon, as they say, it just occurred to me that he can't come on Sundays. Okay, and now your assignment for today is to try to go through this Gemara. If you can add another few lines, because I don't want to push the envelope in terms of the time. And what I need you to do is go through Rav Huna, which is the third example of Halacha Psuka. What we're going to try to analyze is why the Gemara needs three different examples of Halacha Psuka. The third example of Rav Huna will take you another, let's say, three lines in the Gemara. And you'll see the two dots where it says Kibraisa. Do you see that?
Yeah.
The two dots. So that's where in Mirza Shembli Neder we want to get up to today. And then we want to discuss what Halacha Psuka is and what's the difference between Dvar Halacha, which is not allowed before Tefillah, and Halacha Psuka. Is that okay?
Good.
Okay. So Rabosai, I'm going to let you plug away over here. And I'll be back in around. You'll tell me what time is good.
We'll
for
come
you.
In. Okay. Okay, thank you, Rabbi. Oops.
Sorry. We mentioned the fact that there was a double language in the shir, Vaylon Lemisnin, Vaylon Lemisnin. The Marsha says that this is a remez on two reasons why a person should remember the day of his death. One is to overcome his Yetzahara. The Gemara says, the Olam Yargiz Adam Yetzer Tov al Yetzahara, and one of the methods of doing so is by remembering the day of death. The second motivation to do so is that the Gemara says in Shabbos, Shuv Yom Echad Lefnei Misasecha, your clothes should always be clean. You never know when is the last day of your life. You should always be doing tshuva. And the day, remembering the day of death, is going to bring you to the tshuva. So to allude to these two reasons, he repeats himself, Vaylon Lemisnan. Another pshat that's given, and you'll see this here in the Yalkut, is that the Kefal Lashon is because on the first round, since it reminds us of the day of death, the second time around is to remind us of what happens after death, of the Onshim of Gehenna. Another pshat, which is attributed to the Gaon, the Vilna Gaon, he says that the double language is a remez that if a person overdoes it as far as Simcha is concerned, he might come to Chet, and as a result, he might be Chayv Misa. That's how severe it is. And that Misa means that he will lose his rights to be saved and to be spared in this world, as well as in the next world. So this was an allusion to two worlds. And the double language, therefore, could also be a remez to these two misos, the Misa of Olam Hazeh, the Misa of Olam Haba. Now keep in mind, there's a famous machlokas between Beisil, Beishamai, Ksubas Yud Zayin, Ketzem Rag Lefnei Akala. Beishamai says you have to tell it exactly as it is, and Beisil has the frame Kala Nov Achasuda. And the Gemara says that also Kedivrei Beishamai Chayev Misa, that when we paskin like Beisil, you don't have the option of doing like Beishamai. The Gemara says that there was a story in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Sadi Zion, of Mesu Shnei Bonim B'Yavon Sheker, that Sheker is something very dangerous. And now Rav Hamnuna is singing at a wedding of Chasav Akala. If he's going to apply the principle of Beit Shammai, Kal Kamo Shehi, and that's more or less what he'd like to apply because he wants to avoid Sheker at all costs, then Vai Shuyis Chayiv Misa, he'll be Chayiv Misa. But if on the other hand, he applies the principle of Beis Hillel, of Kal Nova Chasuda, then Vai Lo Mioma Misa because of Sheker. This is the double language of Vailo Miyoma Misa. So Mirz Hashem, we'll try to expand upon this at some later point. Now, why did the Gemara tells us that this story happened at the Hilula Demar Bereda Ravina, and they broke a glass. We touched on it last week as to whether or not this would be a problem of Baltashkis and what the leniency for Baltashkis might be. We weren't 100% clear on that, but as to what exactly was the perhaps message here of this breaking of a glass. So first of all, Tosis says that this is the basis for our meaning of breaking a glass at a marriage ceremony. And the reason for this is not to be marbit too much simcha. It's very strange because today they break the glass right before they sing, you know, the mazel tov and break out in a wild dance when that's sort of like is antithetical to the whole purpose of breaking the glass. But other Rishonim say that it's not only b'makom gila sham tehei re'ada, but also what is this breaking of a glass going to do? I mean, is it just going to undermine the entire simcha? So perhaps, as the Meiri says and the Ramah quotes in the Shulchan Aruch, it's a zecher lechurban, that we break the glass at a wedding in order to remember the destruction of Yerushalayim. And that's the idea here at Dafka at a wedding, to break a glass. Again, why does it have to be an expensive glass? After all, we have a principle, Ein Shvira al Dover Shava Pruta Gomeris Itzavon. If it's going to be a meaningful act to induce our sadness, it's got to be a breaking of something of value. And today the minhag is to break anything. You know, you find the cheapest glass and you break it. I'll tell you the story at my father's wedding. I only know this from my father. They snuck in a schnapps glezel into the kerchief, and my father was having a real hard time breaking it. That was part of the shtick that they did. In any event, this Gemara that we're learning here about breaking a glass is a basis for our minog, and that's exactly what we do. We break a glass. We don't break cheres, because that's what happened here in the Gemara. Now, a person who builds a house or plants a vineyard or marries a woman is mizumanim lepigei olam. At that point, because of that special experience and that wonderful dedication on, you know, embarking on a new point in one's life, there's a certain kitrug up in Shamayim. And to break a koser chuppah is going to be, in a sense, to give the midas hadin what's coming to it. It's sort of like, you know, giving to the sar lazazel, you know, to make sure that the sar of kitrug gets his chelek. But there's an interesting interpretation here of the Marshal of the Amshel Shlomo, that the reason why we break a glass at the chuppah is to remember the original kiddushin, and that's the marriage between Knesset Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the time of giving the Torah. And unfortunately, when Moshe Rabbeinu received the Luchos, which was meant to be the Kesef Kiddushin to cement that marriage relationship, he had to break the Luchos. And to some extent, there was a little bit of a break in the Kiddushin because of the Chet HaEgel, and therefore we today have to remember to be careful not to fall prey to that sin, and we sort of duplicate the breaking of the Luchos at that marriage, the ultimate marriage, to breaking by breaking the glass at any marriage. Again, when it comes to Ein Omrim Li Adam Chatei Kedei Sheyizkeh Chavercha, you know, how could we, for the benefit of others, break a glass? And that might mean violating the Iser of Bal Tashchis. So I'll just read to you one line here. He says that the glass that they broke was not a shalem, was not a shlema, it was already a stuka. But perhaps if we invoke Tosus and Shabbos in the sugya of Ein Omrim Li Adam, etc., in Lo Chata B'Pshia, if the person who is about to violate an Avera, and you can save him and spare and protect him from that Avera, is a Shogeg and not a Poshea, he's not deliberate or negligent, then we do apply the principle of Chatei B'Shvil Shetizkei Chavera. And in that sense, this sugya would support that sheet in Tosfos. And Tosfos has a number of different sheets, but that particular opinion in Tosfos, here, as we apply it, at Mar Brei de Ravina's wedding, at that wedding, that people were violating a sin, then what we could do is, since we assume that their exceeding joy and their disposition for laughter was a shogeg, it wasn't a pshia, therefore he could violate. But again, it has to be what we call an iser kal, and therefore the shvira sakos is defined as an iser kal. And therefore it makes sense to violate an iser kal to prevent them from the more serious iser of badche tuva. That was the cheshbon here at the wedding of Mar Brei de Ravina. Now, there was also a benefit for the person who broke the glass. He gets hanah from the fact that he saves his friend from a chet, and therefore maybe you could say that's not called derech hashchasa, right? To violate the iser, it's got to be derech hashchasa, and here it's not called derech hashchasa, because he benefits from the fact that they became serious. Why glass? Some want to interpret that glass actually can be reconstructed. It has a takona after shvira, and that's a remnant to tchias hamesim, that even after death there will be a tchias hamesim. Also keep in mind that glass is perhaps reminiscent of the Yetzer Hara. And why is that so? Because the Gemara in Sukkah says that the Yetzer Hara is called, it has many different names, the evil incarnation is called a michshol. And the word michshol, if in its numerical, mathematical calculation in Gematria is 400. And this glass was worth 400 zuz. And that was a reminiscent that the Yetzer Hara is trying to be machshel us in this extra, you know, simcha, and therefore we have to be careful about that, and we have to protect ourselves from that simcha. I want to just read to you one line here in the name of the Alkutei Shlomo. I'm not familiar with that sefer, but he quotes it in his anthology, that Ra'as Talmidei Chacham Smech Ve'Heven Shesmechasim Hi Mikach Shalomdu Har Beit Torah. He understood that their simcha was the simcha of Torah. Shibar lefneim kos chuchis, for as a remez, the Gemara says in Chagiga, that divrei Torah kasha leknosam kekli zav, v'noach liavdom kekli chuchis. You know, glass is something very fragile, and Torah also, and its knowledge, is very fragile. And therefore, it's not great that you add Torah and increase your Torah study. That's great, but that's not the ultimate. What you have to do is make sure, guarantee, do whatever you can to guarantee that you won't lose the Torah like you could lose glass. It's very easy to, you know, it's easy come, easy go. There's another thing that I wanted to call your attention to. It's again, there's so much here. Asur li adam shiyamale schok piv ba'olam azeh. The Ramban writes in his Torah Sa'adam that the Isur applies during the period of Golus, when we're in the diaspora. And the Pasuk itself is a remez to the period of time after the end of the diaspora, after the redemption, azimale schok pinu. Then we'll be able to widen our mouths with a full laughter, a full smile. Keep in mind also that on Purim we're allowed exceedingly to be in a state of schok, and maybe the reason for that is because nafal pachad ayehudi aleihem, because the nations of the world that put us and subjugate us in Golus on that day have nothing to say, because that was the day in which our enemies in Shushan and near Shushan were overwhelmed with fear of the Jewish people. Now we can really have a sort of a me'ein geula, and we can be mamale schok pinu. The Me'iri, by the way, writes that the termination of this Isur Yamali Skok Pinu is at the time when Mashiach comes, and it could be that what really will allow us to be Mamali Skok Pinu once again is the building of the Beis HaMikdash, because the prohibition against Skok Piv is during the period of Churban. Churban is antithetical to Milui Schokpinu, and therefore at the point of the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, then and beyond, we're allowed to be Mamale Schokpinu. Now, there's something in Rabbeinu Yonah that I want to call to your attention. He says, the Gemara's language is Ba'olam Hazeh, in this world. They didn't say that the Isur is a result of Churban Beis HaMikdash, but rather, even during the Zman of Beis HaMikdash, there is an Isur L'malos Schok Piv. And the reason for that is because Simcha will bring a person, if it's too excessive, to forget the mitzvos. That's the Shita of Rabbeinu Yonah. And therefore, when the Gemara says, which sounds like that at the time of the Geula it will be mutter, he says, nisim oz nisim hi simcha sabore vihi mitzvah gidola. So according to Rabbeinu Yonah, it's not that the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash is matir this simcha and milui schok pinui, but rather this simcha at the time of the Geula will be permissible because it itself will be a simcha shel mitzvah. As we said before, excessive simcha simcha is antithetical to asiyas ha-mitzvos, but here the mitzvah itself essentially is simcha. What we do is we demonstrate the great miracles of Hashem and the salvation that He brought upon us. We publicize this. We publicize the Nisim Niflos at the end of, at the period of Geula, the ultimate Geula redemption, which will exceed by far the original miracles at the time of Geulas Mitzrayim. That experience and that project, so to speak, implementing the Maisa of being Mefarsayim Hashem's Nisim, that is the greatest act of Simcha, because we're bringing through this glorification of Hashem's name a Simcha of the Bore, Kaviyochol, it's the Creator's Simcha, and that's a mitzvah gedola. The Taz has a very interesting diuk. He reads the Shulchan Aruch meticulously, and he was wondering why the Shulchan Aruch didn't add this limitation clause that the Iser is only Bisman Hazeh. And it sounds like the Iser applies even when we're not in Golos. And he makes the following distinction. He says, "Bizman shebeis hamikdash haya kayom, then the iser was to be mamale schok piv schok rak besimcha shel reshus aval besimcha shel mitzvah kigon simchas beis hashoeva, or the case of David HaMelech when the Aram was returned, then you're allowed to be mamale schok piv." And the Taz seems to be walking in the footsteps of Rabbeinu Yonah. You know, he's saying that the Iser of Schok, Milui Schok Piv, applies even Bizmana Beis HaMikdash, but the Heter, which gives us license for that, is the Simcha Shel Mitzvah. You've got to convert it to Simcha Shel Mitzvah. But the examples he gives of Simcha Shel Mitzvah is not, as we saw Rabbeinu Yonah, to publicize the great miracles of salvation of God, but rather those cases or situations which require Simcha. Like, for example, on Sukkot, we have a mitzvah of Simchas Beis HaShoeva. David HaMelech is an example when we brought back the Aron, and he was Mecharkir B'chol Oz. Those are cases, you know, of Simcha Shel Mitzvah, and that we're allowed to do when there'll be a termination of Golus. During the period of Golus, then even if there is a Simcha, but nevertheless, it's still... the Iser of Mamali Schok Piv still applies, even in a Simcha Shel Mitzvah, even at a wedding. And his language here, Vizman Golus, She'orva Kol Simcha. Sure, what the Taz means by Orva Kol Simcha. Let's see, Rabosai, if we can if we can put together some of the ideas that we spoke about before, and we'll look at the Gemara inside, and then I want to share with you something that I found here in the commentaries. Now we're on Daf Lamed Aleph Omed Aleph. Rashi tells us on the top that Kasa Demokra, right, which we didn't understand exactly what the case was. What was the difference between the first case and the second case? You remember that in the first case, it says Kasa Demokra. I'm sorry, is that the first case or the second case? The first case says Kasa Demokra. And Rashi says Kasa Demokra Kos Shel Zchuchit Levana. It was white glass, and that apparently is a specialty. And then Rashi says, Lishron Lanmar Shira, they were asking him to sing a song, this Rav Hemnuna, and he sang the song of Hey Torah Vehei Mitzvah Demignu Alen. Rashi says, Heichan HaTorah Sha'asaknu. Where is the Torah that we studied? We engaged in Torah study, and where did it go? Heichan HaMitzvah Shanu Mekayimin. Are we really holding on? You know, it's not just enough to do a mitzvah, but heichon, we have to possess the mitzvah, she'agenu aleinu, and they should protect us, midina shel gehenim. What does the word dina mean?
The judgment.
Excellent. Halacha psuka, Rashi says, she'ena tzricha iyun. It doesn't require any sort of iyun. Now that's the big question here. What does Rashi mean by iyun?
Investigation.
Okay. I would offer a slightly different interpretation, but it's pretty much the same, David. And that is in depth, exactly, to analyze. There are two types of Torahs, Rashi says. There's the halacha, which is called Dvar halacha, which is really the evolvement of halacha. And then there's the final halacha, the bottom line. For example, if you open up a Mishnah Brura, or maybe a better example would be a Kaf HaChaim, which is a Sephardic. There you get just the bottom line. You know, there are no pilpulim, there are no investigations, there's no in-depth analysis. That's called halacha psuka. But if you're getting get involved deeply in some sort of analysis, and then go daven, what's going to happen inevitably?
You're going to be thinking about it.
Right, exactly, exactly. You won't be able to concentrate and focus on your davening. So even though Torah study is a great thing, but maybe that's not the thing you should be doing right before you daven, but rather what you should be doing is learning halacha psuka, which means clear-cut halacha, which doesn't require any sort of what? Any sort of iyun. And that's what Rashi points out. Shalo yehe maharher ba bitfilah. So what's ba in the feminine? Torah. Torah is feminine. So you shouldn't be thinking about the Torah while you're davening. I have to tell you a little story. My Rebbe Rav Salvechik was once asked a question at the end of the shiur, and we used to daven mincha right after the shiur. So I'll never forget watching him daven mincha. And he davens, he goes like this, he davens, then he goes like this. Well, about your question. And we all wondered, come on, like, was he really concentrating on his davening? It's like the fastest Shmoneh Esrei you could ever imagine, you know. But, right. Rabbi Solomon.
Never cheese the rock. You teased him about it?
No. I just noticed it. I saw it. About your question, you know. Is Yosheves Olea Zayin Nikim? Again, what did she... At 11 o'clock, we're learning Chumash. Please tell everybody, you know, to be here at 11. They should be here punctual. Okay. So what is Yosheves Olea Zayin Nikim? What does it mean that she sits 7 clean days? Again, first Rashi wants to point out, Levad, with the exception of Me Oso Yom Sheposekes, right, which is the last day that she saw Dam, and then she completes the day with a bedika and checks herself out to make sure that she has no more Dam. And I don't know if you gentlemen have ever heard of something called a Moch Dachuk. The Midig was, in this context, that she should ask, actually place into her privates there a cloth that would stop up the place, so that if any dam went out, it would be absorbed in the cloth, and then she would take out the cloth and see what's going on over there. Vatorah lo itzricha zayin nikim, but the Torah doesn't really require that she should have to wait seven clean days. Ella only in the case of zava. And how do we know this? Rashi is going to quote a pasuk: shenemar v'im Tahara mi zova. Okay, then, and if you take a look on the side, he's going to tell you that this pasuk is in next week's parsha. I don't have a chumash here, unfortunately, but if you open up to Vayikra Tesvav, you'll see that the Torah says that a zova requires zayin nikiyum. The ein zova, Rashi says, ella haroa. What does haroa mean? Okay, please underline that word. Haroah means she sees. Everything in the laws of Nida are all revolve around the word re'iyah, or roeh, right? Roeh is the conjugated verb of re'iyah. Re'iyah means that she sees dam. Shlosha yamim ritzufin. What's ritzufin?
Continuously.
Excellent. Non-stop, without any interruption. So let's say if she sees on Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that's not Gimel Yomim Ritzufin. And not only that, in order to become a Zava, she has to see 3 consecutive days, Bitoch Yud Aleph Yom, during the 11 days. Shedein Nida Linida. As I told you, the month, the cycle month for a woman in Halacha, again in Halacha, is that first she, any dam she sees first, let's say the first time in her life that she sees dam, she becomes a Nida. Okay? When she finishes Nida, then she goes into a period of 11 days, which is called Yemei Ziva. It doesn't mean she sees anything in the 11 days, but in event that she sees Dam during this 11-day period after she completes her Nida period, then if she sees three consecutive days, she becomes a Zava Gedola, who requires what?
Seven
clean days, Zayin Nikiyim. After she finishes the 11 days, Bein Ziva LeZiva, then she's in a different period of time. She reverts back to her original period of time, which is called Yemei Nida, which means if she sees Dam, she's a Nida, which according to Torah law means as soon as she stops seeing Dam, the following night she goes to Mikvah, and she's allowed to resume relations with her husband. So the only case of Zayin Nikiyim on a Torah biblical level is if during the 11 days between Nida and Nida, she sees three consecutive Rios on three consecutive days, then and only then she becomes a Zova Gedola. The first day that she sees during the Yemei Ziva, she becomes what's called a Shomeres Yom. Shomeres Yom means she's watching that day, meaning to see if there'll be another day. The second day she's also Shomeres Yom, and if she sees on the third day consecutively during this period of time, which is called Yemei Ziva, how many days make up the Yemei Ziva? 11, that's the magic number. Then and only then does she require Zayin Nikiyim. But the women, the Bnos Yisrael, took upon themselves a chumrah that they always assume that maybe they're during Yemei Ziva. And that, by the way, makes a lot of sense because it's very hard for a woman to remember exactly where she's holding, if she's during these 11 days or not. But the real super duper chumrah is that even if she sees a tipas dam kechar, the one tipas dam, because there's no way that she could have seen 3 days consecutively if she only saw one tipas dam. In any way, this is a halacha psuka. And who gives us this halacha psuka? This was quoted by Rav Zeira. Correct? It's the famous statement of Rav Zeira. And now we move on to the second halacha psuka. What was the second halacha psuka? That was Rav in the name of Rav Hoshaya. Rashi points out, machnisa, what it means, he takes it in, bibayis, into his house. And what was the status, what was the situation of that tvu, of that grain at that point when he took it into the house? Bimot shalah. What does it mean, bimot shalah? Kodem shez yizra osa. Rabbi Osai, please write this down. There's something called zoreh. Zore is Zayin Vav Resh Hey. And in fancy English, it's called winnowing. And Kodem She Yisrael, so before he did the winnowing, he took it into his house. And now Rashi gives us a long explanation. It says Rashi, She'ein mischayev b'maser min haTorah. As far as Torah law, he's not obligated, right? Lo mitchayev, that's causative. He doesn't become obligated, according to Torah law, Ella Biriyas Pnei Habayis, only if the actual grain sees the walls of the house. Now, how does that happen? How could the grain itself see? If the grain is completely covered by its chaff, right? Then it cannot see, in inverted commas, cannot see the Pnei Habayis. But Misha Nimrach, after it was subject to Zoreh. Now here's a synonymous word for Zoreh. And that's called Mei Ruach. Maricha, Mei Ruach. Mishanimrach. Mishmirch means winnowing. Bikri. Bikri means what happens is that after the wind blows away all the chaff, the grains fall into a kri. A kri is a pile.
I can understand why we had trouble with this, Rashi.
Yeah, no, this is challenging. But Rabbi Meis told me that you learn Rashi. Am I wrong?
Well, you can learn Rashi and get lost in a Rashi.
Right. No. But I'm saying what I'm doing now is that within the curriculum.
He would have gone through those words.
He actually goes through the Rashi for us
He usually goes through the Rashi with us first.
Oh, yeah. I see. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you'd do the Rashi on your own, and then we do it together to compare Rashi notes. Aval ifnei miruach, if he took it into into the house before winnowing, ein re'ias pnei abayis kov asal. Okay, now keep in mind, the key word as far as maser is concerned, to engender the isur, is kovea, okay? To be kovea something for maser. Kovea something for maser means that it went through all the stages necessary to become maser. Number one, it grew in the ground. Which ground? In the land of Israel, not in France and so forth, right? Number two, it was cut from the ground. That's called ktsira. And number three, it has to have what's called meruach, which means the winnowing. Number four, it has to have kri. Kri means when all the grains are now falling into a pile. And number five, you have to take the grains into the house. At that point, you are kovea lemaser. Okay? Now here, what did he do?
Even if you're not going to use it for... only if you're
going to
use it.
Kovel Abasa means now you have to give it to whoever you have to give it to. Well, we didn't discuss that yet. So, that there are 6 years in the Shemitah cycle before we get to Shemitah. Mm-hmm. In the first, second, fourth, and fifth years, we have to give 1/10 of our produce to the Levi. That's true, actually, for all 4 years. All 4 years. I'm sorry, correct me, correct on that. That's true for all 6 years, I meant to say. Okay. Then in addition to 10% of the produce for the Levi, which is true for all 6 years, we have to give another 10%. But here it depends on whether you're in years 1, 2, 4, and 5, or years 3 and 6. If you're in 1, 2, 4, or 5, then the second 10th has to be brought to Yerushalayim, and there it has to be eaten, b'kedusha u'betara. If you're in the third or sixth year, then instead of the second 10th being brought to Yerushalayim, that second 10th is given to the poor people. That's called Maser Ani.
So you have a pretty lean trip to Jerusalem those years.
What do you mean by lean?
Well, you don't have much money. You don't have as much money as you did in the first, second, fourth, and
sixth. Right, fourth and fifth. There's no need to bring the Maser Ani to Yerushalayim. I mean, to give it out to the Aniyim. But in any event, it's not your money. You have to give it to the Aniyim. So you're right. At least the Maser money you could eat, in Yerushalayim. But the truth is, the Gemara tells us in a few places that most of the farmers had so much Maser, a tenth of their produce was so vast, that they weren't able to eat it all up in Yerushalayim. So what they did was they redeemed it onto coins, and they gave it to relatives of theirs that lived in Yerushalayim, who would have the whole year. They lived in the farms far away from Yerushalayim. Their relatives would have the whole year to use that money to buy food and eat at B'Kedusha B'Tara.
So they built up some credit with people in Jerusalem to go the next year.
Right. The Jerusalemites were waiting for their relatives to come to Yerushalayim, with all that maser money. But you're right. On an average year, that means 1, 2, 4, and 5, you ended up with only 80% of your produce. Because 10% went to the Levi, 10% you brought to Yerushalayim, but how much of it could you eat? In the cases of 3 and 6, you have even less than 20. You have even less of the 20% that applies to the other years, because the second 10% is given to the Ani. That's given to the poor people. And I imagine in my mind that the rich people in those days were the farmers. Today it's more an industrial society and there's finance and so forth and so on. But back there in the day, it was mostly an agricultural society. And to give 20% of your produce, for the rich people, that was always, in a certain sense, a tax, that was imposed for the Levium and for the Aniyim, and they taxed the rich.
Right.
Not like Robin Hood, he stole from the rich to give to the poor. We don't steal, we expect the rich people to give 20% of their produce.
In the first shiur, you made a distinction between food that you were going to use for a regular suda and food you were going to use for snacks and food you were going to give to your animals. But you've sort of said that any of this food that you've done the winnowing and it's in your house, is
awesome.
It's all
that has to be given, whether it's to the Levi, whether it's to brought to Yerushalayim, whether it's to the
Onan. So where does this distinction
go? Oh, but here, what we're talking about is a case where we drop down from the Doraisa level to the Drabanan level. We're missing one of those five conditions that we have to have to get to the Chiyuv Doraisa of Maaseh. What condition are we missing? Meruach. The Meruach has to take place, the winnowing, in a definite sequence before he brings it into the house. Mm-hmm. If he changes that sequence, which is called Marim Adam Al Tvuas, he does this Harama, as we discussed before, then he reduces his level from a Doraisa to a Drabbanan. And what did the Rabbanan say? The Rabbanan said that even though you successfully outsmarted the Torah, you circumvented the Torah law, nevertheless, we're not going to allow you to eat this food. But the condition is, we're not going to allow you to eat this food in achilas keva, if you eat it as a full, serious, ordinary meal. If, on the other hand, you eat it as an achilas aroi, or you give it to your animal, which I think Rashi is going to explain that right now, he says, "Aval ifnei meruach," if he brings it into the house before winnowing, "ein re'ias habayis kovaso." Why is that? And Rashi says the following: "Degabe truma umasa." With regard to truma umasa, ksiv, the Torah says, "Dagon reishis deganecha." Okay, that's a pasuk in Parshas Re'eh, I believe. And Vehiya Meruach. Okay, now we have three words now for Meruach. We have one word which is called Zoreh, which is one of the 39 categories of Malach on Shabbos. We have another word called Meruach. And now we have a third word, which is a biblical word, and that's called Digun, or Dagan. Now, if you travel here in the land of Israel, you'll finally come to a place called Beit Dagan. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a major center. You'll see that's where the Chayalim get Trempim and everything else. So if you go, that, the name Beit Dagan means that that's where they did the winnowing. There was a place where they used to bring the Tefuah and they did their winnowing. Oh, so the Torah says it's got to be Dagan Diganecha. There's got to be a winnowing process. Lefichach, therefore, kishemach niso, when he brings the grains inside Labayis into his house, kodem meruach, before he took off the chaff, lo hukba lemaser minatorah. Remember, we said that there are various conditions to be koveya maser, and one of the conditions is that the meruach has to take place prior to the entry into the house. However, Rabbanan hu di asru, and I'm going to take a breath here, even though I'm in the middle of a sentence. The Rabbanan said no go. We understand that there's a different kind of kviyas that's going to substitute and replace the kviyas doraisa and generate the iser of achilas maaser, right? And that is achilas keva, a regular, ordinary, serious meal, and that achilas keva is going to substitute for what we called Gmar Malach. Gmar Malach, again, that final stage is when you remove the chaff. So even though you didn't remove the chaff, but if you want to eat an Achilas Keva, you're not allowed to do so. Like today, for example, there's something called whole grain bread. And you can get all sorts of different types of whole grain bread. The poor people back in the day used to get a bread that was very coarse and very hard because the chaff and the bran was all mixed in together. And this was cheaper bread because they could avoid all the work that was necessary to get what's called soles, you know, a very fine flour. Now the health bugs claim that the finer the flour, the less fine it is for your body.
Right.
Because it's more processed, and it's more what they call carbs, which we're, as if you leave the bran and the chaffs in, it's more what they call a complex carb, which means the body works very hard to convert it to sugar and so forth and so on. But in any event, what he could do is theoretically, he could say the following: you know what? I'll never be chayv in maser. Why? Because I love these grain breads. Maybe he sells them on the shuk, I don't know. And what he does is, inevitably, he skips the process of winnowing, takes his grains into the house, and with the grains, he grinds this, you know, this
heavy stuff,
this heavy grains with the chaff on them, and makes a very thick kind of flour. Oh, so the Rabbanan said you're not allowed to do that. Why?
If you just wanted to give that to your animals, like even without.
Oh, that's going to be an achilas aroi. But let's say he wants to feed it to his family,
right,
or sell it on the market. So that once he makes it into a bread, that bread becomes what's called an achilas keva. And even though on a Torah level he's not chayiv maaser, but the Rabbanan he's not allowed to eat it.
Uh-huh.
But here, what did he do? He's going to feed it straight away to his
animals.
He's not even going to be bothered to remove the chaff. Aval achilas aroi lo asu. The Rabbanan never prohibited a temporary or an insignificant kind of achila. Umachel behema, whenever you feed your animal, aroihu. It's always by definition a kind of transient or temporary achila. And how do I know this? Is Rashi disnan. What does disnan mean? Well, you have to underline that word. Disnan means we learn it in a Mishnah. The Maseches Peah. You know that there's a section, 1/6 of Mishnah is called Zroyim, which deal with the agricultural laws. And the first Masechta is called Peah. Peah means the corner. Right, you have pay over here, like you have five payos here where you're not allowed to shave with a razor. And then there's the payah of a sada, which has to be left for the poor people. Okay. I learned Masechta Peah. It was the only Masechta in Zroim that I ever learned. How long do you think it took me to learn payah?
A long time.
A year.
Yeah.
And payah is the easiest Masechta in all of Zroim. It doesn't even represent 10% of Zroim. You begin to get a taste of how broad and how endless the Torah is. You can get Chalish Tadas from it when you think about it.
They wanted my son to learn a Mishnah a day. They put him in a special class with other groups. They had to learn a Mishnah a day, and it starts off with Zarin and Peah with the first and second. And I was helping him.
No, but the truth. No, I have to tell you truthfully, I think they did the smart thing, because the way I learned Peah is not the way they have to teach your son. How old is your son? 6?
8.
8 years old, he can learn what's called Mishnayis with Kahati.
Yeah.
I learned Peah with Yerushalmi. Okay, because there's no Bavli on Peah.
Oh, is that right? Really?
No Bavli on Peah. All of Peah is Yerushalmi.
Hmm.
And it's. I once said a Chiddush in Peah that I thought was the original idea, and I told it over to Big Tom Chof, and he liked it. So I sat down and I wrote it. I published an article that was 40 pages long. On one line in one Mishnah in Peah. And Peah is the easiest Masechta in Zroim. So to take an 8-year-old and teach him Peah, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful idea. Hopefully, in Mirtz Hashem, that's my bracha to you, when he gets older and more mature, and he really wants to get into it, be'iyu, and not before davening, then he will learn Peah with Yerushalmi. And he has already a basis. He has a little bit of an orientation because he went through the Masechta. I once asked my class in Mevaseret, I used to be the Rosh Yeshiva in Mevaseret, I asked the class if anyone learned Peah. So a guy named Benji, you know, he raised his hand. So I said, Benji, how long did it take you to learn Peah? He said, 8 days. Because he ran through Mishnah's Peah with Kahati. I said, it took me a year and I barely finished it. So the Rabbanan asered an achilas keva, when it's a real serious achila, before, when he brought it in before Meruach. But in the case of Machil Behema, the Mishnah says in Peah, Machil Behema, he's allowed to feed his animal, Chaya, the more, you know, serious animals, the faster animals, V'o for the birds, Ad Sheimareach. He can continue doing this until he does Meruach. Now what happens if he takes it into his house before Meruach, then takes it out of his house and he does Meruach? So that's going to be a gigantic machlokas whether that is Gemar Malacha or not. But certainly Midrabanan, it's considered Gemar Malacha once he actually does the Meruach. So therefore, if he uses this grain to feed his animals without doing Meruach, that's called Achilas Aroi, and the Mishnah says that that's permissible. Hilkach.
But the therefore, is permissible or not?
No. That's the thing. When I say permissible, I mean it's absolutely permissible. Hilkach Behemto Ocheles Uptu. That's what I just said to David. It's hard sometimes with Skype to hear me, but what I said to David was that if you take the grains into the house before removing the chaff and you feed it to your animals, that's perfectly permissible. Even the rabbis allowed that. What the rabbis did was they said that if you eat an achilas keva, which means that you sit down and break bread at a meal, that's prohibited, even though you did the shtick and you brought it into your house before removing the chaff. Avol Ihu, if he wants to eat it as a human being, Osir Bachilas Keva, he cannot do it with an Achilas Keva.
Okay. You're
allowed to feed it to your animal as long as you don't eat it yourself and as long as you brought it into the house before Meiruah. If you want to eat it, that's already called an Achilas Keva. And midrabanan, in terms of this rabbinic enactment, it's prohibited for you to eat it. If you're feeding it to your animal, it's okay. But as a human being, you're not allowed to eat it. That's already becomes an achilas keva, which is rabbanan prohibited. But in order to reach the level of maaser min haTorah d'oraisa, that would require that you took off the chaff before you brought it into the house. That's called gemar melachto. Kodem Knisa Labais. Now, just to test you, who can give me three different words for winnowing? For winnowing, three different words, just to see if you got it. It's a little revision. Meiruach. What else?
Can I look at?
Go ahead. Meiruach. Zora Yisra is a conjugated active verb, but the Zria. And number three, Dagon, or actually it's called Digun. Digun.
Isn't Dagon the word for grain?
Yeah, but Dagon has two meanings. Dagon is a reference to the five species of grains, but Dagon could be converted into a verb, and that's Digun. So instead of reading the Dalet with a Kamatz underneath it, you read it with a Chiruk, and to emphasize that, you'll add a Yud after the Dalet. Digun is the act of winnowing. And that's called, again, if I just want to confuse you and give you a fourth term for it, that's called Gmar Malacha. Mm-hmm. Now, the term Gmar Malacha is a halachic term. The other three terms are really Lashon Kodesh. Those are Hebrew terms that mean winnowing. But if I want to give you the conceptual term for winnowing, what does winnowing accomplish? That's called the Gemar Malacha, meaning there are many, many different malachos that go into making bread, but the last malacha amongst what's called the Sidur de Pas, in order to organize, is going to be the winnowing, which is called in the Mishnah and Shabbos Zoreh. Zion Vav Resh Hey. And if you're ever interested, there are 39 malachos, but I would say there are 38 plus 1. Zoreh is a category unto itself. Because in all the other 38 cases, the human being does the actual action. Zoreh, all he does is throw it into the wind. It's the wind that actually does the action. And this introduces the most profound concept in all of Shas, which is called Koach Acher Merurbo Ogroma. All of the shilas that you'll ever have in modern contemporary life that deal with electricity and so forth, they always come back to the sugya. There's a sugya Bava Kama on Daf Savach. It's very easy to remember. The round zero of Savach. And that's the sugya of Melech Zoreh. Why am I chai for Zoreh when I just simply throw it up into the air? That's called Koach Acher Me'urupa. But that's on the side. That's not going to help you for your exam in Masechta Brachos. When is the exam, by the way?
Just kidding. It's also borrowed as well, because aren't you taking the good from the bad?
But that you're doing actively. You actually pull it out. You take out the pebbles, you take out the thing.
Okay.
Or take, for example, Katsiri. I go out to the fields with a sickle and I cut it down. And I go on and on. In Zria, I put the seed into the ground. In Harisha, I have to turn. Now, Harisha is also a little unique because sometimes you use an animal. And the question is whether that's also considered koach acher me'urupo. And then you have something called afia, where you put the dough into the oven and the oven does the baking. Is that called koach acher me'urupo? So again, you could literally spend a lifetime trying to understand the laws of groma. Now they have something called the kosher switch. And the rabbis didn't like it. The kosher switch allows you to turn on lights and close them on Shabbos. And the question is whether it's not considered grum.
Right.
So if you ever want to study that, I gave a series of two lectures on that, which I put on the YU site. It's called YU Torah. Yeah. I just have to take a break, David, to get a little water. I feel like I'm, it's like pikuach nefesh.